Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
A UN commission calls what's happening in Gaza genocide.
This is likely to be the benchmark now for the issue of genocide.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today we look at one key aspect of that report. Also on the show, Baltic states like Lithuania are trying new approaches to dealing with the Russia threat.
Citizen preparation, even in the civilian side, is actually very important for us.
Enter drone school for kids.
And in Thailand, there's a big market for electric vehicles, and manufacturers in China are trying everything to get people buying.
Does some of this stuff seem cheesy? Yeah. Is some of this stuff going to fail? Of course.
Why the competition should still be nervous.
And the search for a breakfast of champions goes global.
That's all today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday. We begin the show today with an engine of the global economy, the auto industry. These days, on average, a new car costs about $50,000 in the U.S. In some parts of the world, though, you could get two or three cars of that price if it was an EV made in China.
Chinese EVs are making big inroads in foreign markets. Topping that list, Thailand. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports that the consumer trends playing out there do not bode well for the competition.
For many drivers in Asia, an electric vehicle from China is more than just a car. It's a whole vibe. Influencers even create ASMR videos of all the satisfying sounds their cars can make. That car is called a Build Your Dreams Atto 3. At the controls are two young women from Thailand who call themselves EV girls. They go by Ai and Pang. They are electric vehicle super nerds who love the click of a charging port snapping open or the ding-ding of a turn signal. Here's Pang in conversation with her car. Hi, Aura, she says. Can you please shut the sunroof? She's inside an Aura Goodcat made by Great Wall Motors. It looks like a futuristic Volkswagen Beetle. It comes in many colors, but this one is pistachio green. Pang and I are naming every Chinese EV brand they can think of. There's BYD, Geely, Zeekr, Chang'an, Deepal, Ion. These aren't models of cars. These are entire automotive companies, like Ford or Toyota. On social media, I and Pang rack up tens of millions of views as the EV girls, reviewing mostly Chinese cars. Not because they have some big affinity for China. It's just that China rules the world of electric cars. Pang says Chinese technology is clearly rising fast. In Southeast Asia, the cultural impact, like the sheer cool factor of Chinese cars, is huge. You know how baby boomers obsessed over Mustangs and Camaros? That's how many Gen Z people in Asia feel about Chinese cars. Only this time, young women are apt to be just as car obsessed as guys. Pang and I tell me the moment they were converted. They were in a Chinese EV, and they put a Coca-Cola in the car's refrigerator, which was so powerful, the Coke froze. Chinese EVs often have unique features, like that refrigerator, or in-car karaoke, or massage chairs, or even aromatherapy. Another one of Pang's favorites is a godsend to anyone who hates parallel parking. Crab mode, she says, is when a car turns its wheels and slides into a parking space sideways. Chinese EVs have gotten really good really fast, according to consultant Tu Li. He runs a firm called Sino Auto Insights.
I've driven dozens of these cars. I've seen the progression, seen the evolution.
Showering Chinese cars with praise is not something Tu Li imagined doing as a young man. He's from Detroit, and his first car was a Pontiac Sunbird with hand crank windows. He grew up in a family that would not have tolerated a non-American car parked in the driveway. He's even worked in corporate roles for the big-name automakers.
I'm a GM, I'm a Ford alum, and my brothers and sisters, are virtually all of them, have worked in the automotive space in Metro Detroit. So I'm rooting for them openly.
Thing is, he says, when it comes to EVs, Chinese cars eat everyone's lunch, to a degree that Americans in particular just do not grasp. The Chinese government has subsidized tech companies to make cars and then let them slug it out in the marketplace, fighting for customers in China and now across the world. This cauldron of competition leads to wild innovation. BYD's new feature is a drone that launches from the roof of the car to check out traffic.
Yeah, first of all, it's real. I've seen it. And it's not super practical, and it's probably not something that most people are going to buy.
But with more than 100 Chinese EV makers, they have to constantly come up with more and more extravagant features.
You need to stand out some way. And does some of this stuff seem cheesy? Yeah. Is some of this stuff going to fail? Of course. But that doesn't stop them from trying it.
There's a BYD SUV that can float in a meter of water and steer like a boat. This stuff is astonishing, but maybe not as much as the price. Tu Li says Toyota or Chevy should be terrified.
The legacy automakers, they really can't touch a $9,000 price point or a $10,000 price point.
Yep, just $10,000 for some models sold in China. A more typical price would be $15,000. Pang from the EV Girl says Chinese EVs are giving the thrill of car ownership to young people around the world who never thought they could even afford a new car. She also says, who knows, maybe some of these features might break in a few years. But for now, they fill her generation's needs. A tricked-out car for under $20,000 would clearly make many Gen Z Americans pretty happy, too. But to protect U.S. automakers, the U.S. government imposes a 100% tariff on Chinese EVs. That went into effect under President Biden, and Trump kept it. Pang says, for a rich country like America, isn't there an obvious solution? She says, if Americans want these cutting-edge features in U.S. cars, why don't they just copy them? Well, there is a cheaper EV coming out in the U.S. next year, a truck called a Slate, backed by billionaire Jeff Bezos. The base model comes in one color, gray. There's no stereo, no cruise control, there's crank windows, and it's expected to cost about $27,000. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Online betting makes gambling easier than ever, and that comes at a cost. Gambling losses worldwide could top $700 billion by 2028, according to a study in the journal The Lancet last year. Some U.S. states, like Massachusetts, are trying to get ahead of the problem, but none of them is coming close to the approach that Norway takes to control gambling. Reporter Karen Brown from New England Public Media has our story.
A gambling arcade in Oslo, Norway, couldn't be further in mood from, say, a traditional resort casino in the U.S. Here's what it sounds like at MGM Casino in Springfield, Massachusetts. And here's what it sounds like at a Norwegian betting place on the second floor of an urban strip mall. People sit in faux leather chairs in front of silent computer terminals.
I have to enter my phone number and birth date.
Bjorn Helga Hoffman logs into his national gambling account to play blackjack on one of the machines. He starts out betting 2 kroner, roughly 20 cents.
I could increase it to 5 kroner per spin.
Hoffman works for the state-owned gambling company Norsk Tipping. And like all Norwegian residents, he's only allowed to lose a certain amount per month, about $2,000. On the first game, he waits for the quiet spinning to stop on the screen.
So does that mean you won or you didn't?
Yeah, I did win.
You did?
Yeah, on one hand, not the other.
Okay.
You can barely tell, There are no bells, no manufactured sounds of coins falling into a steel bowl.
All those sounds are meant to make you play more, if you see.
So it's hard to get excited by the win, and that's the point. Norway's gambling monopoly is based on reducing gambling impulses. There are no casinos, just slot machines, bingo, lotteries, and horse racing. And the government not only limits how much time and money people can spend, it also limits the style and pace of games to make them less addictive. Charlie Thompson is a Norwegian gambling researcher.
There is an inherent discussion on how much regulation should the state have and how much liberty should its citizens have?
This question has been dogging policy leaders around the world as online gambling expands rapidly. In the U.S., almost 40 states now allow online sports betting. And while some praise Massachusetts for paying attention to problem gambling, compared to Norway, it's practically the Wild West.
First of all, you have to play identified.
The Norwegian government tracks each person's gambling habits as part of the country's harm reduction approach. Hoffman says everyone has to set limits before they even start to play.
How much can you afford to lose in the cold light of the day?
Jani Engebo is a policy advisor for the Norwegian Gambling Authority. He compares Norway's regulations to airbags in cars.
So if it gets really bad, you will not have so severe consequences that you cannot carry on with your life.
Engebo's research suggests the rate of gambling addiction in Norway is less than 1% of the population. It's about three times as high in the U.S. But 25 years ago, Norway had a problem. Slot machines were all over the place, supermarkets, airport lounges, ferries, and there were no spending limits. Magnus Pedersen is with the advocacy group Gambling Addiction Norway. He says people didn't understand how addictive gambling could be. He says it's like going into a bubble.
Well, it's just you and the gambling. Every stress, everything, every problem you have, everything else just goes away. But after a while, it's not enough with $100 or $200. You need $1,000 or you need more.
Pedersen's group helped convince the government to remove all privately owned slot machines and, in 2007, replace them with slower, less addictive machines in fewer locations. And when online gambling arrived, Norway added more limits on time and money. It banned VIP loyalty programs and betting bonuses. Plus, gambling profits all go to charity, not private industry. At Oslo's central train station, one convenience store offers betting machines, and it still gets a steady stream of repeat customers. But manager Fredrik Heidelberg says he doesn't have to worry about them spending all their money.
The system mostly takes care of that for us, because there's a limit to how much you can spend.
And while researcher Charlie Thompson says some people may want more freedom,
in general, Norwegians are much more tolerant towards these invasive policy tools.
In contrast, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission has put in measures that allow players to set time and spending limits. But Mark Vanderlinden, who oversees the state's Responsible Gaming Office, doesn't think U.S. regulators or players would tolerate mandatory limits like Norway has.
The commission is monitoring what's happening in other countries, but you know, there's been a lot that had been tried. Sometimes it can work really well in a country, one country, and fall flat in another country.
But even Norway has seen some pushback. At one Oslo sports pub, bartender Nemo Gasparim was checking scores on his phone. He says he's an avid online gambler, especially on U.S. hockey games.
To be honest, the Norwegian rules are a bit silly.
Gasparim says he prefers better odds and fewer limits, so he goes on foreign gambling websites that are illegal in Norway.
I know that it's not healthy, you know, but I do it because I think it's fun.
Yeah,
I will never stop.
This is an addict.
Norwegian regulators say they are trying to shut down the black market through banking bans and internet blocking. Bjorn Hoffman says they are also trying to make the legal games more exciting.
It doesn't help if you have the best responsible gaming framework or measures in the world if no one wants to play with you.
For The World, I'm Karen Brown.
Tomorrow, we will hear Karen's reporting on how the UK treats gambling, which some people see as a cautionary tale.
The Netherlands put a stop to drilling on one particular natural gas field. The lawsuit that stems from that action tells us a lot about how hard it is to address climate change. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In the Netherlands, residents of the province of Groningen were supposed to be getting payouts from Shell and Exxon, compensation for damages caused by decades of drilling at a huge gas field there. But instead, the companies are suing the Netherlands over those payments and because the government closed the gas field last year. We asked Lucas Schauga to break it all down. He's with the International Institute for Sustainable Development based in Canada and Switzerland. He says it all stems from something called the Energy Charter Treaty.
And so the treaty allows for certain foreign investors in the energy sector to sue the states they have invested in before international arbitral tribunals, which is what Exxon has now done. And so the way this works is that the state provides a consent in advance for foreign investors to sue it outside the country's own courts if the investor claims a government decision has harmed its investment. And that seems to be what Exxon is doing now. It's arguing that the advanced closure of the gas field has harmed its investment and that it had a legitimate expectation that it will continue to incur profits from that investment for, you know, the foreseeable future. The tribunals, they typically consist of three arbitrators, one of which will be appointed by the state, one of which will be appointed by the foreign investor, and then there's also a presiding arbitrator. And these three member arbitral panels or tribunals, they will hear the case and they will take a binding decision, which will also be binding on the state, and it will be globally enforceable against assets of that state. And what is important, and also an important point of criticism of that regime, is that the decisions of arbitral tribunals are not usually subject to appeal. So unlike in a domestic court system, exactly, those are final decisions, whereas in a domestic court, courts will sometimes also grant deference to decisions that are taken in the public interest, as in the Groningen example, where, of course, decisions relate to environmental consequences and damages for a whole range of house owners and local residents.
And so to clarify, it doesn't matter what happens with arbitration or court cases in the Netherlands. Exxon can still bring this case to the international tribunal. And it's not like there's a precedent or something. That it's just these three people who will make the decision.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And so one important characteristic of those international treaty-based investor-state arbitration cases is that the tribunals are not bound by precedent. That means they're not bound by domestic precedent. They're also not bound by previous decisions of international arbitral tribunals. They can basically, decide the case based on the facts before them. And in addition to that, the underlying treaties, like the Energy Charter Treaty in this case, are usually drafted in a very broad and open-ended way, which additionally leaves a lot of, discretion to the arbitral tribunal to actually decide the case.
So I'm curious, specifically in the case of oil and gas, as governments are thinking a bit more about the environmental impact of extraction, are these cases becoming more frequent?
Yes, absolutely. So fossil fuel firms are already among the most active users of the investor-state dispute settlement system worldwide. And these cases are often high-profile cases. So we see, for instance, a claim by Nord Stream 2 against the European Union. We've seen a major arbitration claim against Italy related to offshore oil extraction. And often the types of decisions that are being challenged are climate laws, drilling bans, revocations of permits, decisions to phase out coal-fired power generation, or decisions to impose windfall taxes on energy producers. So the problem really is that even the prospect of multi-billion euro claims can delay or dilute a government's climate measures. And the case against the Netherlands shows this dynamic as well.
I can see from the perspective of these big companies, though, that you do want some sort of reasonable expectation that billions, millions of dollars of investments will allow you to keep working for a certain amount of time. So there is a protection here that, you know, helps keep business humming. Is there a way that environmentalists or other legal experts are trying to think about how to reform this that would protect those interests as well?
Of course, absolutely. And I think there is a legitimate case to be made in favor of investment protection. However, one has to question the scope of that protection. There's also a question whether investment protection should differentiate treatment between different forms of investment. And then there's also a question whether the open-ended form of investment protection that is included in investment treaties is really adequate. One can have a contractual relationship with an investor, but why would a state want to provide blanket consent in advance without knowing which investors it will face before an international arbitral tribunals, where the tribunal can take, you know, binding decisions? That is definitely not, I think, the way to go. The move should be to tailored and restricted forms of investment protection that actually take into account the public interest.
So a specific contract rather than this open-ended right to arbitration that you mentioned?
Yes. For instance, one way one could address this issue is by introducing a multilateral investment court that would solve many of the current criticisms of the ad hoc ISDS regime when it comes to the frequent, you know, conflicts of interest of arbitrators, the opacity of the system, the lack of binding precedent. Other means that are being discussed at the UN as well are questions whether damages awards should be capped at the amounts invested, whether it is really adequate to allow arbitral tribunals to come up with awards that are largely based on, you know, speculation of any future profits, or whether that practice should somehow be reined in. And at the OECD, we have the discussions around a possible carve-out, a climate change carve-out that would remove, you know, fossil fuel investments or climate change measures from the purview of consent to ISDS.
I do want to just point out, though, that, you know, you're speaking from a perspective that this is a bad thing for the environment, but the energy companies, I'm sure, like this kind of protection for their investment, their huge investments that they make with the expectation of being able to make a return on those investments.
Of course, they have these expectations, but I do think that the energy transition and policies implementing the energy transition are all about shifting incentives. Many of these companies are also investing in renewable energies. They have, you know, internal processes and shareholders holding themselves to account. They have their own policies that they start to implement. So I do think this is a question in a shifting field where one has to take into account these factors as well.
Lucas Schaug is a policy advisor at the International Institute for Sustainable Development.
Still ahead this hour, an assessment of genocide in Gaza and the pressure on Israel to defend its actions in the Palestinian territory. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. Last week's votes in Congress to eliminate federal funding for public media are a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. President Trump got the royal treatment today outside of London when he and the First Lady spent time with King Charles and Queen Camilla, along with the Prince and Princess of Wales. This was the first ever state reception for an American president at Windsor Castle, and the royal family went all out. There was music, a 1,300 troop honor guard, royal carriages, the works. Today's events were mostly pomp and ceremony, but there has been one announcement of substance, a transatlantic tech agreement. It commits billions of dollars worth of new investments to the UK from big tech companies in the US. The World's Matthew Bell has that story.
American technology heavyweights led by Microsoft say they're ready to invest in Britain to the tune of $42 billion. The plan even has a name. The Tech Prosperity Deal includes investments in AI, quantum computing, and civilian nuclear projects. British officials are talking about it with great enthusiasm, saying it will boost economic growth and security on both sides of the Atlantic. Jensen Huang, the CEO at NVIDIA, said the deal will help make the UK an AI superpower. And here's the leader at Microsoft, Satya Nadella, speaking to the BBC.
We are making this capital investment in the UK soil, right? So these are AI factories, cloud factories that are very much part of the infrastructure of the United Kingdom. And so you have now trusted American technology that UK can use and companies across the UK can use to create more technology for the United Kingdom and for the United States and the world.
In as little as 5 years, Nadella said, the British economy could see real benefits from these tech investments. Prime Minister Keir Starmer said, this is about putting more money in people's pockets in every corner of the country. His government signed a trade agreement with the Trump administration back in May, but the British economy is struggling. A statement from Starmer's office describes the tech prosperity deal as a generational step change in our relationship with the U.S., Ishwar Prasad is a professor of trade policy at Cornell University. He says $42 billion is a sizable amount of money, but that it's not momentous for U.S. tech giants like Google, Microsoft, and NVIDIA. And if the U.K. really was such a promising market for these companies, it's likely that they would have made these investments already.
There probably is a lot more to the story than meets the eye. But especially if the UK is going to gain significantly in terms of GDP or other measures of economic activity, you know, that gives companies like Microsoft and NVIDIA some bargaining power. And they will certainly be looking to extract every pound of flesh that they can. So what these pounds of flesh are, I suspect we will hear more about in the coming months and years.
Prasad says this deal is not likely to be a game changer for the UK economy, at least not in the near term.
But it signals something very important, that the tech partnership between the US and the UK is moving on to firmer ground. And it probably means that these American companies are going to be able to partner with British firms.
The UK has been trying to separate itself from the regulatory policies of the European Union, and Prasad says that may be one attraction for American tech companies.
They have a sort of implicit promise from the UK government that they will be able to operate more freely in a less restrictive regulatory environment. And this might be one reason why the UK government is very eager to be part of the deal, because they do want to be seen as a dynamic economy and a government that is keen to make sure that businesses feel that they can thrive in that environment rather than being severely constricted by regulation.
Prasad says you have to wonder what else U.S. tech companies are getting in return. President Trump and Keir Starmer will have an opportunity to offer more details on Thursday when the two leaders hold a joint news conference at the Prime Minister's country retreat. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
It is being called the strongest legal assessment to date to determine whether Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. The 72-page UN report released this week concludes that Israel has committed multiple genocidal acts. One of those acts, preventing births, or preventing the conditions necessary for birth within a group. William Shabos is a professor of international law at Middlesex University, London. When we spoke today, he explained why that's an important part of this report.
This was put in there because of experience with things like sterilization and the prevention, segregation of the sexes that there was evidence of during the Second World War in some of the Nazi atrocities. So it's considered to be one of the acts of biological genocide, along with things like sterilization, which didn't make it into the convention.
So to make this case, what did the UN Commission have to show in this report?
Well, the part about preventing births, it's the fourth act. There are five acts in the Genocide Convention. It's the one that's had the least attention probably over the years, and it's only now coming out. It's being invoked in some other cases of genocide as well. What the commission focuses entirely on, it represents two pages in the 72-page report, is the destruction of an IVF clinic, an in vitro fertilization clinic that was storing sperm and I think some eggs. And they say that the destruction was deliberate. There's no military rationale for attacking it. And so the result is that they say that objectively this prevented births within the Palestinian group. So it's an act of genocide, and that's the conclusion of the Commission of Inquiry.
Central to any genocide claim is intent, and Israel denies civilian infrastructure has been deliberately targeted in Gaza. Could these damages be explained as collateral damage or legitimate targeting because of the presence of combatants?
That's for Israel to come and say in defense, I suppose. The Commission of Inquiry, it's quite clear, didn't have any cooperation from Israel. Israel has never cooperated with the Commissions of Inquiry. This is the third main Commission of Inquiry that has been created by the Human Rights Council since the late, 2008, when the first one was set up. So if this ever was to be addressed in court, in, for example, the proceedings at the International Court of Justice, then it would be for Israel to say, actually, we were targeting a military objective and to provide evidence of that.
Israeli officials have denied that the Al-Basma clinic only had a reproductive function or that its destruction was intended for that purpose. What is the counter argument in this report that can override those denials?
Well, this is, as I say, it's one of four paragraphs in the Genocide Convention. The main one is killing members of the group. And the issue really is whether you can demonstrate that the prevention of births took place with the intent to destroy the group physically. This has been the problem with some of the other allegations in other contexts. So there are allegations in the Myanmar case that measures of birth control were measures to prevent births. The same in China with the allegations of genocide directed at the Uyghur. And there, the difficulty is that certainly with China, we don't have it corresponding to very clear evidence of physical destruction of living people. And really, the core of a genocide case is going to be that.
As to the four pages of the report that address preventing births, or really any part of it, could these events be explained by the fog of war, the possibility that certain facilities might have been used for non-medical or mixed purposes? Like, how does that play into the assessment?
You know, that will be, of course, Israel's argument and defense that this was all just, as you say, the fog of war. This is battles going on, and that the battles were legitimate military undertakings. Israel is claiming that this is all purely military, or The other part, but it's related, is rescuing the hostages. My own assessment of that, and I'm speaking now not about the report so much, but my own assessment is that the Israeli armed forces themselves haven't really suffered very many casualties. The number of combatant deaths by IDF, Israel soldiers, is significantly lower than 1,000. This is in a battle where everybody knows that at a minimum there are 60 to 70,000 Palestinian deaths and perhaps many more. So there's a disproportion there that suggests to me that Israel actually isn't fighting Hamas very hard and isn't trying to rescue the hostages with great energy either. If they were, then they would have probably had a lot more casualties. And so what they're doing effectively is attacking the civilian population using air power, using drones, using robots. And that ultimately that's demonstrating what their real purpose is to drive the population, either to drive them out or to kill large numbers of them so that the population is reduced and ultimately destroyed.
As for actually investigating genocide on the ground, what was the UN's methodology for this report when really only the IDF and the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation can get inside Gaza?
Well, they, of course, are in contact with people on the ground. They interview witnesses using Zoom or using their iPhones, and they can talk to people and gather evidence. I don't think that's a serious obstacle now. And, of course, there are people on the ground who are cooperating with them. But when you're talking about the issue of targeting, and when Israel is arguing that they were targeting something because they had information that would lead them to conclude that it was a military objective, then really they're the ones with the evidence. They're the ones who know this, and so they have to be able to demonstrate. You know, we encounter this problem in law all the time, and particularly when human rights violations take place, that ultimately it's the alleged perpetrators who are in possession of the evidence. So we need to hear their answer. We need to see their evidence. They can't just say, oh, it's all military. They have to make that credible. They have to make that believable, and they have to have evidence to demonstrate it.
Mm, but what you're saying is this report is primarily based on firsthand accounts, or, I mean, is there other evidence or testimony that can be gathered?
Well, it's based on a combination of materials, but there's a huge amount of monitoring going on in there, and they have that. There's a statement that was made by six Western governments, the Germans, the French, the British, the Canadians, the Dutch, and the Danes, that was submitted to the International Court of Justice in another case, which is the case against Myanmar, where they talk about these reports, and they say these reports from the United Nations are highly credible and provide very, very strong evidence to assist the court in ruling on genocidal intent. Now, this glowing assessment of the reports was done by these six countries before they knew that Israel was going to be targeted in a way.
As you know, various organizations and actors have weighed in on calling Israel's actions on Palestinians in Gaza a genocide. The word has become something of a lightning rod. What do you think is the significance of the UN now applying this label, especially as it's about to host leaders next week for the General Assembly?
There's definitely a lot of momentum in the charge of genocide. There's more and more support for that controversial label about what's going on. I think that this report now is going to be the most authoritative report on the subject for the next few years. This is likely to be the benchmark now. It may also lead to more litigation at the domestic level and maybe even more cases at the International Court of Justice against some of the states that are assisting Israel for complicity in genocide. But only time will tell whether that happens.
William Chabos is a professor of international law at Middlesex University in London.
China is close to opening the tallest bridge in the world. It's more than 2,000 feet off the ground, nearly twice as tall as the Empire State Building. And it is expected to transform travel through one of the country's poorest and most isolated provinces. The world's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reports.
If a 2,000-foot-high bridge sounds absolutely bananas to you, you are in good company.
This bridge is totally different than the conventional ones.
Mamdou El-Badri is an engineering professor at the University of Calgary, where he's dedicated much of his career to studying infrastructure projects that make you go, whoa. El-Badri has never seen a project quite like China's new Huajiang Grand Canyon Bridge, a heavy suspension structure that cuts through rugged, mountainous terrain and towers above a winding river in one of the country's most remote corners.
The bridge is made up of segments of steel trusses. The total weight of the trusses is 22,000 tons.
That's about two Eiffel Towers, hoisted up from the canyon floor and carefully laid into place under extremely volatile weather and intense gusts of wind. Doing that required constructing another record-breaking piece of engineering, the world's largest cable hoisting system. El-Badri says crews also use satellite imagery, ultra-high-def cameras, and a series of sensors that help make sure conditions are safe for installation.
They provide real-time data regarding the weather conditions in terms of wind speed, temperature fluctuations that are actually provided to the engineers and the construction crew to adjust the strategy in proceeding with the construction itself.
The technology worked, and China successfully completed construction earlier this year. Then last month came the big test.
3,360吨, 也就是模拟在极端荷载作用下,
That's the bridge's load test director, Lei Min, explaining to the South China Morning Post how Chinese authorities assessed whether the bridge is safe to use. They put a huge fleet of 96 trucks on it to make sure the bridge could handle a heavy load, even with intense wind shaking it. The bridge passed the test and is ready for traffic just 3 years after construction first began, a rapid timeline that you'd never see in other parts of the world, where similar projects often take a decade. So how did China do it?
That's a great question.
Wei Zhang is a Chinese economist and professor at Princeton University. He says while the bridge's speedy construction is impressive, it's not surprising. Building big and building fast is what China does. In fact, the previous record holder for the world's tallest bridge was also in China. The record holder before that, China too.
Because China has built so many this kind of high bridges over the years, right? It has the build up the expertise and also has the tools and the workers that needed for this kind of project, right? So that's why you can quickly pull this off in 3 years.
Zhang says the country invests roughly 10 to 15% of its GDP into infrastructure projects like the Huajiang Bridge. The idea is to spark local economies. When you decide to build a bridge, you need people to build the bridge and you create jobs. Then there's the continuing economic effects of having a new connection to other regions. Zhang calls it the Chinese version of stimulus checks.
China has a different economic system that allows the state to control and allocate a significant fraction of resources in the economy. Infrastructure development is one of the dimensions that really reflects the strong state capacity to allocate the resources.
According to state media, the total price tag of the Huajiang Bridge was $280 million. China does not release figures on worker safety, injuries, or deaths related to construction. The bridge is expected to open by the end of the month. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Lithuania shares borders with Russia and Belarus and has a population of less than 3 million people. It's trying to build up its defense capabilities. The latest approach, setting up schools to train civilians as young as 10 years old to use drones. The defense ministry has 9 planned training sites. The first is now up and running. I talked to Lithuania's deputy defense minister, Tomas Gadliauskas, about the effort to train kids to use drones for national defense.
When we talk about this particular course, the kids are the ones who are actually having the possibility to get required competencies, and we are trying to deliver them the knowledge on the newest technology and how to use the drones, how to construct them, and how to play and compete between each other. So this is one of the long-term investments into our kids, long investments in our technological engineering thinking. And we hope that this kind of skills will also benefit our young society.
So you say this is all for building military defense capabilities. Are these kids learning specifically skills that have to do with defense or offensive military moves? Or is this just training on how to use regular store-bought drones?
Exactly. This is just civilian purpose. There is no direct connection with defensive use of the drones. This is particularly possibility for the kids just to get the required knowledge about this new technology, how we can build them, how we can construct them, and how we can use them, and how actually for the kids even just to play with them.
I would imagine that the idea, though, is that this facility with drones could, you know, translate into either defensive or offensive uses of these drones, which we have seen extensively in the war between Russia and Ukraine. What kind of strategy are you looking at there?
First of all, we look that, of course, all those youngsters, they will attend those kind of classes. Maybe in the future, it will be the good knowledge and competences what they will gain. And maybe later they will join the armed forces and they will use these knowledges and capabilities. At the same time, those centers, as I mentioned before, is also a spot for the citizens who are actually getting the knowledge about the drones. And we are actually registering those people who are going through this training. More or less, this is just for the civilian resilient purpose. Sometimes those people can be integrated into the mobilization system. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those people can be integrated into the municipality efforts, whatever it would be, just to provide the information what is needed.
So this is all, as you said, part of a larger effort to get civilians ready for defense. How much of that is in reaction to the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and Russia?
I would say is directly related. We as the eastern flank of NATO and the border of European Union, we have this threat perception from Russia very well. And for this particular reason, we understand that citizen preparation, even in the civilian side, should be, you know, about how to provide a medical aid or how to be prepared for the extreme situation. So this kind of a topic is actually very important for us, and we are investing in our society to be more resilient and prepared, how to separate this information, how to be resilient in the cyber domain. So those kind of the competencies actually is very important for each citizen. When we talk about the military, so this is even more qualified and more deep preparation required. So we, as a NATO country, as a Baltic region country, investing 5% of the GDP, and we are planning to invest in the next 5 years more than 5% of GDP just to building our defensive capabilities.
So on a day-to-day basis, how much are people actually worried about potential aggression from Russia? I know that Russia sent some drones over Polish airspace just recently.
Yeah, this is, if we talk about the Russian influence in our region, so first of all, is a lot of hybrid sabotaging activities, violation on the critical infrastructure, space, GPS jammings, artificial migration from the Belarusian side. There is also the various of the incidents on the disinformation and propaganda field. We are facing a lot of attacks on the cyber domain. So this complex of various of threat actually is building the need for us to build those kind of societal and national, you know, resilience towards our adversaries.
I'm wondering if you have kids or if there are kids in your life that you talk about this with, or if you have friends or relatives that you know are talking with kids. I'm just kind of wondering what those conversations look like just around the dinner table at night, how you talk to kids about this threat of war.
So I have 3 kids, yes, and 2 already grown up and 1 is 3 years old. So, you know, I did my 21-year service in Army, so my kids was always following my duty and my responsibility to my country. And in this kind of dedication and responsiveness and responsibility to provide, you know, safe environment in the state is very important. And I think that this kind of the values is very important. And this is actually the common effort from the governmental side and from the political side, the politician side. That's why we actually trying to invest and to talk with our society more.
I was asking kind of about how you reassure kids or help them process
the possibility of conflict, but your answer was more about instilling in them the duty to serve, it sounds like.
I would say it's more that it's all about education. So it's all about awareness. It's all about competences and knowledge. And it's all about education to understand and to have those kind of sense and knowledge required just to be, you know, individually resilient, organizationally resilient, and nationwide resilient.
Lithuanian Deputy Defense Minister Tomas Gutlauskas.
It's easy to throw shade on social media, influencers, and online spectacles, but we've got to give a shout-out to Spanish influencer Ibai Llanos. For the past month, he's been pitting nation against nation for the World Breakfast Cup, or El Mundial de los Desayunos, with celebrities and politicians weighing in on traditional morning meals from 16 different countries. Millions of people follow the contest, seeing the French croissant go down in a tough face-off against Spain's tostadas con jamón.
Atop the final bracket, the winner was Peru for pan con chicharrón, bread with crunchy fried pork rind. Renzo Gomez Vega writes in the newspaper El País that Peruvians were more enthusiastic voters in this competition than they were in their last presidential election. Not sure if that says more about Peruvian politics or Peruvian cuisine. The coveted World Breakfast Cup trophy is a golden frying pan.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. You can be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.